FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking with Professor Dan Guillory about the Lincoln Poems, his most recent book. Welcome, Dan.
Oh, proud to be here.
And this book has been out just this year, and it's been doing very well. Many people have appreciated these poems sort of about Lincoln and in the voice of Lincoln, perhaps the mind of Lincoln.
Yes.
I want to ask you about how you've come to do all that, but let me just remind listeners, this is a live call-in show, so we're happy to have your questions and comments. Just give us a call in Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. If it's long distance, use our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. And we know we have many listeners online, so anywhere you can hear this program in the continental U.S., you may use that free 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Dan, am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Yes, that's correct.
It's Guillory, and the book is called The Lincoln Poems. How did you happen to come to write it?
It's a long, complicated story, but I think essentially I'd been doing a lot of research on Lincoln, and at some point I decided to do a series of sonnets on the love relationship between Abraham Lincoln and Anne Rutledge. I worked on that for actually several years. It didn't seem to work out quite because I wanted to do some longer narrative poems that didn't really work in the sonnet mode. And that's how I really hit upon this book. I was also very interested in Lincoln's voice, and as much we don't have digital recordings, obviously. But we have a lot of ear witness accounts of how Lincoln talked and how he pronounced words. But it wasn't just voice in that sense, but voice in the sense of how he phrased, how he balanced ideas.
The way his mind worked.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Really getting to the heart of how he constructed ideas and feelings in language.
Now, in addition to being a writer, you have been a professor at Millikan University for how many years?
32 years.
32. In what area?
I taught English.
English.
But and that meant creative writing, film, English literature, a variety of things.
In a small liberal arts college, you, a faculty member in English, gets to do a number of things.
Correct. Absolutely.
And did you have a specialty there?
Well, probably I did creative writing and English literature were the two I did the most.
Uh-huh.
Although they seemed very different, it wasn't all that different.
And did you discover a few budding poets over those 30 years?
Actually, I did, and a few have gone on to publish, and some are teaching at various colleges, which is very gratifying.
Uh-huh. Since this program deals with themes of spirituality, religion, ethics, values, mm-hmm. all things like that, when I read your book and heard you read your poems even before that at a reading in Urbana, I was impressed by the sort of moral issues that you deal with through Lincoln's eyes and were, of course, in Lincoln's time.
Yeah, I think that, a great deal has been written about whether Lincoln was a Christian or whatever. I really see him as a deist, basically.
Someone who had a belief of God, in God.
In God, but not necessarily in a denominational God.
Or even a Christian God.
Or even a Christian God. As I said, Lincoln did not believe in the Trinity, and he didn't believe in the divinity of Christ, and it's sort of hard to call yourself a Christian if you don't believe in those. On the other hand, he made it very clear, particularly when he ran against Peter Cartwright for the House of Representatives, that he was always a theist, not an atheist, and that he was very devoted to sacred writ. I mean, Lincoln knew the Bible very, very well.
Yes, didn't he? Yeah. And quoted it particularly in the second inaugural. It's just
absolutely
filled with images from
The last, I'd say the last year of his life, Lincoln was very, very much concerned with the idea of providence and the whole theme of some master plan for all of this. And he believed that possibly because the war was so trying that he came to believe that as a matter of fate, there had to be some reason for all this and some good, not necessarily pro-Southern or pro-Northern, as he kept reminding people, we don't really know what God's providence is.
Uh-huh. Let's hear a poem.
Sure.
What have you chosen for us?
I think I'm going to start with a poem that pulls together many different strands of Lincoln's life and activities. It's a poem that occurs based on a true event that occurred the day before he left Springfield. And we know he left Springfield the day before his birthday, which would have been February 11th, 1861. And, of course, he gave his famous farewell address from the platform of a railway car. At the depot, the Great Western Railway Depot, addressing the citizens of Springfield. The poem is called Billy the Barber, and you probably know this, Steve, but for the benefit of our listeners, each one of the poems is prefaced by a little historical context.
Paragraph, as much as a page.
Yeah, it's just sort of setting the scene for the poem, not really telling you what the poem is, but sort of giving you some essential background. William de Florville, or William Florville, was Lincoln's barber for 24 years, his neighbor for a time, and the guardian of the Lincoln home when the family was in Washington, D.C. Born in Haiti in 1807, he immigrated to Baltimore in 1820 and learned the barbering trade. In 1831, he arrived in Springfield, setting up shop in 1832. Very successful and visible in Springfield, in the business community, Billy the Barber was also a flute and violin player, a considerable philanthropist in the growing frontier community, and a composer of serio-comic verses, which he published in the Illinois State Journal. And this was sort of his marketing strategy. Billy will always be found on the spot with razor keen and water smoking hot. He'll clip and dress your hair and shave with ease and leave no effort slack his friends to please.
Now, let me say quickly, that's not your poem.
No,
that's Billy the Barber's
that's
own
Billy
words
the Barber.
that we have from historic research that you quote in this introduction to your poem, which we're coming to.
But Lincoln, too, wrote poems, so there's a little bit of poetry all over the place here. His shop was on Adams between 6th and 7th. Billy charged 15 cents to cut the hair of men and boys, 20 cents for girls. He cut Lincoln's hair on February 10th, 1861, the day before Lincoln left for Washington. On December 27th, 1863, he wrote the president, "Tell Taddy," and that was the youngest son, Thomas Lincoln, "that his and Willie's dog is alive and kicking." I also use the word coffle in this poem, which is a chain gang of prisoners or slaves.
And now we are ready to hear a poem called Billy the Barber from February 10, 1861. This is a poem written by Dan Guillory and is found in his book, The Lincoln Poems.
Billy is mopping my face with a hot towel, stropping his straight razor, adjusting the chair, and I gently slumber as this free black man scrapes 8 inches of sharp surgical steel over the soap-covered vessels of my neck. Once on the Ohio, I beheld a coffle of slaves, 3 men, 2 women, and a little girl. The oldest man had white woolly hair, and his back crawled with gray, wormy scars, his eyes filled with the blankness of being sold downriver. How many are still in coffles? Billy tries to snip and dress my thatch, a touch of pomade, a little wet combing. I feel something like a pressure drop before a storm, a squeezed-down moment, as if everyone suddenly started speaking a different language or time angrily stopped. It is the end of slavery. It is today. It is now. I tip him 2 bits, shake his hand, leaving as if nothing has happened, walking down 7th Street, utterly certain I will never pass this way again.
We've just heard the poem read by the author, a poem called Billy the Barber, from a collection, The Lincoln Poems, written by Dan Guillory. So here's a poem in the voice of Lincoln, an imagined exercise in how he might have been thinking just before leaving Springfield to begin his life as President of the United States during a time of slavery, and perhaps looking forward to the time when that slavery comes to an end. Did it bother you to try to be in Lincoln's mind?
It was a big leap at first, although once I started doing the poems, it actually, and then especially once I finished the book, it seemed strange not to be doing it. But I did pick up some of Lincoln's peculiarities, one of which was, like many of his 19th century peers, he in his writing, he liked to capitalize all the important words. And so I found...
As the Germans still do.
Yes, they still do, absolutely. And we used to do 16th and 17th well into the 18th century. It was quite a leap at first. But I had started with the love poems, the subjects were perhaps a little more intimate. As we'll see, some of the poems deal with sort of small-scale intimate matters. As we get closer to Lincoln's death, of course, we're dealing more with public matters and matters of state.
And since radio is an unusual medium, people can be turning on and off at any moment. For people who might have missed the introduction to that poem, there is this word coffle, C-O-F-F-L-E-S, coffles, which is a chained gang of prisoners or a chained gang of slaves.
Of slaves, yes.
And you use it twice in this poem, right. That's such a strong image, of course.
Yeah, and Lincoln, of course, the family did live in southernmost Ohio, and he even made some money one day rowing some well-to-do gentlemen from the shore out to a steamboat, and he made 50 cents, which was an enormous sum for him. So he was, you know, acquainted with slavery. And, of course, he made, some people forget this, made two trips down to New Orleans. He had seen slave auctions and of course, the new museum, I can't say new anymore, but the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum
in Springfield
has a diorama of that very thing.
And it's a very, very impressive museum. Folks who have not been to that museum should certainly make a trip
Absolutely.
To Springfield to see it. Those who are farther away listening on the Internet, make a trip to the Midwest, and that's one of the things you should certainly include.
It's worth it.
Very
Absolutely.
Dramatic. And very child-friendly. There are some parts that are very strong, but there are things that children can understand, and it's well presented. And, of course, adults find it fascinating. Now, you've done a lot of research on Lincoln. How did you get started on that? You've written other books on Lincoln.
Yeah. I think a lot of people ask me that. I grew up in New Orleans, for one thing. So, you know, as I like tell people, the biggest two statues in New Orleans are Andrew Jackson and Pierre Toutant Gustave Beauregard, the man who started the Civil War. He literally ordered the batteries to fire at Fort Sumter. So there aren't a lot of Lincoln statues in New Orleans. But I wound up in 1972 teaching at Millikan University in Decatur, Illinois, and right out of my office window there's a huge Lincoln statue. And some people will know this fact. A lot of people think Lincoln was first nominated for the presidency in Chicago. That's not true. It was in Decatur, Illinois. Mm-hmm. The state Republican Party nominated him there on May 10th, 1860, and about a week later he was nominated at the National Republican Convention in Chicago. So there was Lincoln history all around. Another thing was that the first veterans organization, which is called the GAR, the Grand Army of the Republic, also started in Decatur. So I kept the first summer that I was in Decatur, there was literally all of this Lincoln material, and I just started reading a little bit, and then before I knew it, I was hooked. And it seemed to be, as a friend of mine said, you turn over a rock in central Illinois, and there's something about Lincoln under it, and it's not too far of an exaggeration.
Now, your Ph.D. in English literature is from Tulane.
Correct.
In New Orleans.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And where did you go after that before you ended up at Millikan in 72?
Actually, I came directly from that. I had taught at LSU briefly, and also taught as a graduate student at Tulane, and also as a graduate student. I was a graduate student also at Madison in Wisconsin, and taught there also before coming. So I taught about 5 years altogether before I came to Decatur.
Where were you an undergraduate?
I was an undergraduate at Xavier in Ohio, and also finished at Tulane.
Oh.
So I was kind of all over the place.
Moved around a bit.
This was in the 60s, and there was a lot of movement.
I remember those years. We're talking with Dan Gullory, G-U-I-L-L-O-R-Y, and he's reading us some poems from the Lincoln Poems, his collection of poetry out just this year from Mayhaven Publishing. It's available in your local bookstore and online. And if you'd like to get it directly from the publisher, perhaps you're listening online, you can go to mayhavenpublishing.com. Let's hear another poem.
Okay, I think I'll do a poem. This is a poem from the Washington period. It's called Keckley Dressing My Hair.
Sticking with the haircut theme.
Yeah, we're going to go with another hair poem. And Elizabeth Keckley was the modiste or seamstress for Mary Todd Lincoln. She was a former Virginia slave who had purchased her freedom and that of her son by dint of hard work and perseverance. She composed a famous autobiography, which is entitled Behind the Scenes or 30 Years a Slave and 4 Years in the White House. Huh. It's one of our best sources of the goings-on in the White House. And it was originally published in 1868 and then reprinted in 1988 by Oxford. Mrs. Keckley was a remarkable woman who became the most trusted servant of Mary and Abraham. President Lincoln often requested Mrs. Keckley's tonsorial services before events of state. After the president's assassination, she was dispatched to New York to sell off Mary's considerable wardrobe, a futile attempt to raise cash for the beleaguered former first lady. Ultimately, Mary did convince Congress to give her a pension.
Hmm.
And I believe she was the first lady to receive such funds. In 2003, historian Jennifer Fleischner published Mrs. Lincoln and Mrs. Keckley, The Remarkable Story of a Friendship Between a First Lady and a Former Slave.
And we're now about to hear, read by the author, Keckley Dressing My Hair, read by Dan Gullory.
She flexes her fingers like a concert pianist, this African queen, teasing grace notes from my choppy thatch, gracefully playing glissandos on my crown. She presses ever so close, the joist of her hip touching my ribs, her pneumatic bosom swelling against my back, her hands fluttering over my cheeks and beard. And thus the presidential locks lie down in perfect harmony as Lizzie strikes the final chord, gently withdrawing her hands, stepping away as if to admire her artistry, when all too suddenly the music dies.
Professor Gullory, tell us a little bit about your thinking about poetry. You've just read for us Keckley Dressing My Hair. It's, how long? How many lines would this be? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14. Is that a standard sonnet length?
It's not a sonnet, although as I was finishing the book, I realized that, as I said, I had started the book as a sonnet sequence and had written quite a few of those. Many of the poems work out to be 12, 14 lines. Mm-hmm. This one is sets up a little more of a narrative. The sonnet really is best suited for, you know, some sort of proposition, theological, political, moral, some sort of proposition, and then commenting on it. It's always an if-then, you know, a kind of structure in a sonnet, and that's why it has an octet and a sextet, 8 lines and 6 lines. And
this would be the traditional sonnet. Contemporary writers such as yourself stretch things in all sorts of directions.
And don't necessarily follow the rhyme scheme. But most sonnets do have kind of set something up and then comment on it, contradict it on it, or add to it in some sort of way. It's an intellectual process. Many of these poems, and I don't know if I'll read one tonight, but some of them are a lot longer. Some of the more meditative, more musing kinds of poems where Lincoln sort of thinks to himself about a problem or a situation. And others are quite brief. Maybe I'll read one of the brief ones. Let me see. This is although it comes close to a day sonnet. This is called The One-Legged Man. And
read by Dan Gullery from the Lincoln Poems.
And it's dated August 11, 1863. We also know this as a precise date. On a torrid day in the summer of 1863, this would be a few months before he gave the Gettysburg Address, President Lincoln encountered a one-legged former slave who was begging on the dusty streets near the White House. Now, all of Washington was filled with sort of two kinds of unfortunate refugees, the wounded soldiers, and they were literally in makeshift hospitals on all the ground floors of all the public buildings and makeshift tents. And there was a huge shanty town in Washington from all the runaway slaves. So you had a great influx of population that the city was not expecting and or in any way ready to accommodate. According to Daniel Epstein, Lincoln stopped and wrote a check on the spot for $5 to this one-legged man. That amount would equal over $100 in today's currency, maybe more given our current perilous condition. At this time, the city of Washington was swarming with soldiers on leave and refugees from the slaveocracy of the Confederate South. There was no federal policy for dealing with the influx of hungry, homeless, and disoriented persons streaming into the nation's capital.
We've just heard the introduction to this poem read by the author, and now The One-Legged Man.
To lose your nation, your native tongue, your wife, your little children, and everything familiar, that is tragedy enough. Then to suffer the loss of a leg, hobbling around Washington in wartime like a three-legged hound, grateful for scraps, that is insupportable. So on Riggs Bank, I draw a check for $5 American, payable to the bearer, whom I emancipated into a life almost as bad as slavery.
The One-Legged Man, from the Lincoln Poems by Dan Gullery.
And there is still a Riggs Bank still exists, by the way.
Is there still? Let's talk a little bit more about the form of your poetry.
Okay.
It's very accessible. It invites the reader in. I'm sure people find this poetry not only moving, but pleasant to read. Here you've imagined yourself in the mind of one of our most famous historical characters, and so it has that thread that runs through this whole book, and yet you have him in so many different stages in his life and moved by so many different situations. There's many different emotions found in these poems, but your style is clear and I think I could say Lincoln-esque.
Oh well, I would be impressed and take that as a compliment. Well, maybe I can read one that's a few of the lighter ones. There are some humorous ones. Lincoln had a great sense of humor, and there are quite a few humorous or at least lighthearted poems in the book. And as far as sort of taking different forms, I think the more I've learned about Lincoln, and I think you'd find a lot of the heavyweight scholars saying this, that Lincoln really evolved and grew as a person. I mean, the Lincoln who was of the 1830s was really a hack politician in a lot of ways, even though he was a very special politician. One of his first acts was to come out against slavery. Lincoln supported the vote for women. Lincoln was horrified and spoke out against persecution of Catholics, which was very strong at that time. Especially by a group called the Know-Nothing Party, which is kind of the intellectual ancestor of the Ku Klux Klan. You know, so in many ways, I mean, his heart was in the right place at the beginning. But he played dirty politics, quite frankly, in the 30s, played tricks on some of the Democrats, and that changed. I mean, the Lincoln who went to Washington and came back from Washington, and then most people think 1854 was the year that was the pivot in Lincoln's life, because that's when the Kansas-Nebraska Act was passed by Stephen A. Douglas, and that act essentially turned the apple cart over and allowed slavery in the rest of the unsettled parts of the United States, and Lincoln just could not abide that, and that he had pretty much gotten out of politics, and suddenly he's all over the place making great speeches.
Motivated.
Yeah, absolutely.
What have you chosen to read about that?
You
talked about some of your humorous poems. I have one to suggest.
Okay.
On page 44 of your book. We're looking at the Lincoln Poems by Dan Gullery.
Old buck.
An old buck. You mentioned the town of Urbana, and since we're broadcasting from Urbana, I thought that this would be a good one to read. And I realize it has a few coarse words here, which are very appropriate, I think, because Lincoln did have a coarse sense of humor.
On the frontier, that was the
style.
Absolutely. And if we heard him talk, we would hear a lot of his off-color stories. Although there's a four-letter word here, it wasn't always four-letter words, but sometimes sort of grotesque and gross situations that he loved. And people would literally come to the rural courthouses expecting to hear Lincoln after the court sessions telling his droll stories, and which were very popular. And as you're saying, this was the frontier, and although this was during the Victorian period, Lincoln did not have a sense of Victorian prudishness, at least in telling his stories. From 1839 until 1860, Lincoln was a member of the 8th Judicial Circuit Court, riding with his friend Judge David Davis, who was an immense man, about 300 pounds, to such places as Tremont, Mount Pulaski, Metamora, Bloomington, Urbana, Danville, Monticello, Shelbyville, Sullivan, Decatur, and Taylorville. He was thus forced to leave Mary and the boys at home in Springfield for weeks or even months at a time. Life on the circuit was hard, but Lincoln forged many relationships as a traveling lawyer and fattened his purse in the process. He went where the work and the people were to be found. Food on the road was sometimes execrable, and private accommodations were virtually unknown. Things got better and better. By the 1850s, there were decent hotels.
Some hotels,
all over, at least one in all of these places. He went where the work and the people were to be found. Sleeping three or four to a bed was a common practice, since furniture, like money, was hard to find on the frontier. A typical supper might consist of salt pork, beans, and corn pone. Then, after socializing around the hearth, and this would be the storytelling, the lawyers would retire to a corn shuck mattress, which they often shared with two or more strangers. And lately, there's been much ado about whether Lincoln was, in fact, gay, because he slept in beds with other men. By that measure, 98% of the population would have been gay. I mean, it was certainly a common situation and expedient one. Conditions ameliorated considerably by the 1840s and early 1850s, when proper hotels were built in the larger cities. Old Buck was Lincoln's favorite horse on these expeditions into the horse heartland, either saddled or pulling a buggy. Blackstone's Commentaries on English Law was the standard legal reference tool of the day.
And now we'll hear the poem Old Buck, read by Dan Gillery, the author.
Old Buck sways in line with the prairie, as if thinking horizons were made for old gray horses. He listens all too patiently while I rehearse cases, a junior partner who always knows his place. He knows when to canter, when to trot, and how much of a load his back can bear. Judge Davis rides ahead, a behemoth in a buggy, 300 pounds of legal corpulence. Tonight, we'll sup on more fat pork and pone as Buck savors the local Timothy and hay. Then, a tallow candle, a little Blackstone, maybe time to scratch out a letter home, bedding down with the lawyer for the defense, who farts all night, carefully punctuating his brief.
Old Buck, a poem about horse that Lincoln favored, read by Dan Guillory from his collection, The Lincoln Poems, published by Mayhaven Publishing, available in your local bookstore or online from mayhavenpublishing.com. That's M-A-Y-H-A-V-E-N, publishing.com.
And if I can put in a word of appreciation to my editor and publisher, Doris Winsel of Mayhaven, it was very brave of her to take an interest in and accept this manuscript, although she's published quite a few Lincoln books and is very knowledgeable about Lincoln and Mary Lincoln herself. But I was deeply grateful when we began to work together. I should mention horse, Old Bob, who was actual name was Robin, but he was actually in the funeral procession when Lincoln was buried, and they had him, you know, gussied up in funeral attire and so forth. Yeah. He was very close to animals. I'll probably read a few poems about animals before we're done here.
Let's talk a little bit, though, before we do that, too, about the publishing issues around poetry. When Doris Winsel agreed to publish this, she had published other collections of poetry, but most publishers lose money on collections of poetry, as you know, contemporary times. And yet this book has sold surprisingly well, partly because of all the interest in Lincoln, but
That wasn't planned that way, but we weren't unhappy about it.
But partly because I think it is so inviting, and the history you give before each poem is helpful and interesting.
And that almost was not in the book.
When
I first talked to Doris about the manuscript, I asked her if because I had written those introductions when many of the poems were published in Illinois Times newspaper in Springfield, and I said, well, I have them all, you know, all the files together on the computer. I said, do you want me to separate you, just send you the text of the poems or the whole thing? Just send the whole thing. And she really liked it. And I had some trepidation about it. And actually, it's one of the things that people have most appreciated about the book. I've gotten more comments about that than almost any other aspect of the book.
Well, the fact that you're a careful historian, but one who, if I could say so, doesn't show off. I mean, you give just what's enough that's necessary, enough that's helpful, but you don't keep going on and on, which makes it easy for many people. I'm going to ask you if you'd be willing to read the poem about Elijah Lovejoy
on
page 42 because of its particular religious historical nature. But before we do that, we're about halfway through our program here on Keeping the Faith today on WILL. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, and found online at will.illinois.edu. And incidentally, if you've missed part of this program or other programs and would like to listen to them in their entirety via your computer, you may go to our archives found at that website, will.illinois.edu, click on AM, and then you'll find the Keeping the Faith programs back through several years archived that you can listen to at your convenience through your computer. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. Next week, our guest will be Amy Kandrak from Indianapolis, talking about a very helpful resource that she and her mother have put together online called What Friends Do: How to Be Helpful to Your Friends, Family Members When There's a Serious Sickness, Illness, Tragedy in a Family, How to Respond. Many good resources are found through What Friends Do. We'll be talking to Amy Kandrak about how they started that and some of their stories that they've experienced since beginning that very helpful online resource. On December 20th, our guest will be Gary Storm, and a couple other folks who've recently returned from a trip to Palestine living near Bethlehem. So we'll be talking about Bethlehem today in the Palestinian territories in the Holy Land. That's on December 20. But today, let's do get back to our guest. And let me remind listeners, if you have a question or a comment, do give us a call. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. If it's a long-distance call, including if you're listening on the Internet, 1-800-222-9455. I got a very kind letter a week or so ago from a listener in Michigan who can listen only on the Internet, but he says he's in sort of a part of that state where he says it's kind of a cultural desert, and he finds listening to WILL online very helpful in his situation, and he's had some nice things to say about the guests who appeared on this program, and I'm sure he's enjoying today as well. Well, let's get back to our guest, Dan Gullory, G-U-I-L-L-O-R-Y, a professor emeritus from Millikan University in the Department of English there. And he's written several books before this one, one about Lincoln called Living with Lincoln, Life and Art in the Heartland. And you have other books. Let's see, The Alligator Inventions, When the Waters Recede, Images of America about Decatur, wartime Decatur, Macon County. So history has been one of your interests along with literature.
Yeah, history and culture, I think, which I see is very closely intertwined, obviously. And I have a, if I can put in a plug, I have a new book coming out, which is called People and Places in the Land of Lincoln. In fact, and Mayhaven will also be doing that one. It's in its final stages right now. We're doing captions and indexing and all of the final things. And it's a big, thick book for me. It's about going to be over 300 pages. And it has chapters on the culture and background, how people ate and dressed and worshipped.
So that'll be out in 2010?
Yes. We hope the early part of the year.
Now, the Lincoln Poems book is I won't say slim. It's about 145 pages.
Yeah, that's actually pretty big for a book of poetry.
Well, it is.
Of course, it does have all these notes in it. Mm-hmm. And it has an index, which is unusual for a book of poetry. I should also mention, if I can...
But you are a scholar. You can't help some of those things.
I hope. We also have an audio book of the Lincoln poems, which came out this summer. And that's been doing well, too. So, you know, and it's actually me reading all of those poems and the introduction to the book as well.
And that's also through Mayhaven
Yes.
Publishing, which can be found at mayhavenpublishing.com. All right. Well, I'd ask you if you might read this poem about Elijah Lovejoy. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, people who know Illinois history and even, I suppose, American religious history would know Elijah Lovejoy's name. He's a very significant person. He was a radical Presbyterian minister from New England, and he had a brother who lived, Owen, who lived in near Chicago and served in the Congress during the Civil War and was a good friend of Lincoln's. So the Lovejoy families really made a mark in the state. Elijah was a powerful abolitionist and also an anti-Catholic and Pope.
But when he came to St. Louis, he's surrounded by Catholics.
Yes, he's in the – and popery was one of his most frequently uttered words. So he did not get along well with the locals. And when after he settled in St. Louis, where indignant pro-Southern and largely Catholic population drove him and his newspaper, The Observer, across the Mississippi to Alton, Illinois. Once in Alton, Lovejoy continued his highly inflammatory sermons. Irate mobs destroyed two of his printing presses by dumping them into the Mississippi River. Now, sort of a little side note here, Lincoln was a journalist all his life. Lincoln wrote for the Sangamo Journal. He sent op-ed pieces to newspapers during the Civil War. Many of his newspaper pieces were unsigned. But Lincoln was very much a newspaper man with everything. He also owned a German newspaper during the campaign of 1860, so he could get articles favorable to himself into the German population around Jacksonville and Alton, places like that.
Oh.
So anyhow, getting back to Lovejoy, he... In November of 1837, a third mob burned down his warehouse where a third printing press was housed, and they shot Lovejoy dead. So this was again, from Lincoln was very, everyone was very upset. A lot of people were very upset. The abolitionists saw it as, you know, another domino down in the fight for abolitionism. Other people saw it as, you know, freedom of the press issue. And, of course, you know, attacking a minister was still the third issue. He instantly, Lovejoy, became a martyr for the national abolitionist cause. Lincoln, as the historian David Donald shown, exhibited a complex reaction to this troubling turn of events. On the one hand, he abhorred mob violence and the quashing of religious expression and freedom of the press. On the other hand, he loathed the virulent anti-Catholic rhetoric, which was the trademark of this firebrand minister cum editor.
He loathed that.
Yes.
Yeah, the anti-Catholic.
Yeah, right. And that's something really remarkable about Lincoln. I think he really had a clear-headedness that is it's just remarkable given, you know, the context in which he lived. I mean, it was very brave of him to say, no, it's wrong to attack Catholics, because he was in a setting where he could have just looked the other way and no one would say anything. And likewise, his attitude toward slavery. Lincoln had become greatly concerned about the deleterious effects of mob action. And this is probably what gives the poem its real direction, and rabble-rousing in general, which he feared would undermine and ultimately destroy a rational, constitutionally based society. These thoughts were clearly in the foreground when, some 3 months after Lovejoy's death, Lincoln addressed the Young Men's Lyceum of Springfield. A lot of people would say that this was Lincoln's first important public statement.
Speech. Uh-huh.
And these lyceums, of course, existed all over the United States. And, of course, later they were followed by the Chautauquas and so forth. His topic was the perpetuation of our political institutions. Lincoln exhorted the young men to avoid wild and furious passions and to revere the laws as a form of a national political religion. Now, some people have, I think rightly, accused Lincoln of seeing the Constitution, seeing the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Federalist Papers as his holy writ, and that's maybe not altogether wrong. That's why Lincoln, when the South, he literally could not conceive of the South seceding from the Union. I mean, he just couldn't fathom it. And it was one of his few errors. Owen Lovejoy, Elijah's brother, who lived in northern Illinois, ultimately became a U.S. congressman and an important ally of the president. Lincoln came to depend heavily on evangelical Christians, especially the Methodists and Presbyterians, who voted as blocks in the elections of 1860 and 1864, although he personally was never affiliated with any denomination. Getting back to the theme of your program, Steve, I can say, absolutely, and there have been books written by this, including an Oxford historian named Richard Carwardine has written a wonderful biography of Lincoln, and he's done a lot of research on this. But the Methodists primarily and the Presbyterians secondarily elected Lincoln in 1860. In 1864, you could say, just say flatly, the Methodists elected Lincoln president. So the silent majority has been around for a long time, and it wasn't that silent.
And although Lincoln never joined a church himself, and as you said, was a deist rather than a Christian, we can tell from his writings and his statements, his wife was a member of a church in Springfield and attended regularly, as did Lincoln. He attended and was friends with the pastor there.
And who had been very, very helpful when their second son died, Eddie Baker, Lincoln. And that's one of the reasons Lincoln bought a pew in that church, talking about the First Presbyterian.
Well, let's hear this poem called Lyceum, the setting, 1838.
Loss of control is equally loss of the self. Our reason and judgment are all. We cannot execute editors or ministers of God, nor submerge the leaden characters of democracy in the muddy-bottomed Mississippi while maintaining any vestige of humanity. So, Reverend Lovejoy, adieu. And may the multitude of slaves you died to save discover some small measure of peace in this most bellicose of republics, unsafe even for white evangelicals.
So here we have a short poem read by the author, Dan Gullery, from his collection, just published, The Lincoln Poems. This is a paperback, a very fine paperback publication.
And that poem was very much in the sonnet form. It's even broken up, and the second part begins with a so. It's very much in the sonnet tradition.
But without the sing-song rhymes or the rigid meter.
Yeah, there's a little bit of there's some slant rhymes in there and little hidden rhymes here and there.
We're talking with Dan Guillory about his new book, and we're happy to have people call in with comments or questions, or you can simply listen and enjoy, as I'm sure many have already. But the numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, elsewhere, 1-800-222-9455.
I'm going to read a short, humorous one, or not too short one, but it's called Pulling Teeth in Tremont. And on October 20th, this is a true story too, 1841, a dentist in Tremont, Illinois, pulled one of Lincoln's teeth. In the process, quote, bringing with it a bit of the jawbone, unquote. Lincoln also complained that he could neither, quote, talk nor eat, unquote. I use the term quo warranto, which is a lawyer's expression meaning by what authority. In point of fact, Lincoln did not soothe the dentist, no matter how painful the experience was. Tremont, Illinois, was originally part of the 8th Judicial Circuit, also serving as the county seat of Tazewell County, until that distinction was given to Pekin in 1850. Lincoln tried many cases in Tremont, and he was very well known there. Located about 50 miles northeast of Springfield, Tremont was the first stop for all the lawyers following the old 8th Circuit.
And now we'll hear the poem, Pulling Teeth in Tremont, read by the author.
Woe to this petty tyrant of Tremont, a terrible tooth extractor, with talents more suited to veterinarian practice, and teeth of equine or bovine proportions. Why, I shall sue by writ of quo warranto. By what authority does he torture unsuspecting victims in his hard wooden chair, removing the tooth while shattering the tender and protective jaw? Now, unable to eat or speak, I seek just compensation and punitive damages for having lost those unappreciated faculties that make me singularly human.
Pulling teeth in Tremont. Now, you just gave a sort of an aside before you read that, that this was based on fact. Are some of these poems just pure imagination, or do they all have some tie to history?
There are some that are what I would describe as plausible. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote this book and these poems in particular is to sort of fill in the spots. We have a lot of Lincoln's public statements, you know. We obviously know what he thought about slavery and many, many other issues, and how he defended all sorts of people, including a friend of his who was accused of murder, the famous Almanac trial. But we don't know how Lincoln felt about the prairie, sure, about the beauty of New Salem. It was a beautiful little spot when he lived there, reverted to nature shortly after the village decomposed after he left. But many of these poems are about, say, Lincoln's appreciation of a sunset or Lincoln's appreciation of the weather, even though he did not leave any jottings or notations about those.
Mm-hmm. No diary you could find.
No,
right?
No. We would love to have a Lincoln diary.
Yes, wouldn't we? Well, we're down to our last 10 minutes of this program, Dan. Could we move to some of the love poems? You said that that's sort of where you started when you began this writing project. Tell us a little bit about Ann Rutledge and Mary Lincoln.
Well, Ann Rutledge was his sweetheart in, we know this now, has been there isn't any more, you know, however about Ann.
It was questioned for a while.
Yes, and I think the main concern was that both Robert and Mary Lincoln, after the president was assassinated, viewed this as an affront to the marriage, and she would not hear of any other woman having been part of the life of, you know, Abraham's affections. But there's more than adequate evidence that Anne and Ann Rutledge and Abraham Lincoln were, in fact, courting and intended to get married. He even let her use his grammar book, which was a big deal, believe me, because books were rare and they were very precious to Abraham. So they were sort of students together, studying language together. But they were also very much in love, and he took her death very, very hard. He any number of people commented that he was particularly worried about the rain and snow falling on her grave, which is a very poignant little
touch. How old was Lincoln when she died?
He was about 26.
And she was?
About 21 or so.
Uh-huh.
So they were a young couple. They were very obvious in this small village. This poem is called Hummingbirds for Annie. Recent scholarship by professors John Simon and John Walsh has shown that the amorous relationship between Abraham Lincoln and Ann Rutledge was indeed a factual occurrence, as argued many years ago by Billy Herndon, Lincoln's law partner. He did so shortly after the president's death. Mary Lincoln and Robert Lincoln vociferously objected to any mention of Ann. Yet Lincoln did give Ann his precious copy of Kirkham's Grammar, inscribed with the words, "Ann M. Rutledge is now learning grammar." She died tragically on August 25th, 1835.
We'll now hear Hummingbirds for Annie, written by Dan Gullery in the voice of Lincoln.
Okay, and that's on page 30. Paired hummingbirds hanging in the air, golden green, iridescent as beetles. High in the sycamores, cicadas scrape out the last true song of summer. Tones of grass in crook-necked gourds, the sweet cider of memory. Dream girl, flower girl, Annie in the May apples, Annie picking trout lilies, Annie with her nose to a cone flower. Her hair smelled like rain. She wore her skin like a store-bought suit of clothes. Now, under a wet, fermenting moon, I pick my violet bachelor buttons, placing them dreamwise in the little buttonhole of love.
The poem Hummingbirds for Annie. And in this poem, you have several important words capitalized in the style that Lincoln used when he was doing his own writing. Summer. Memory. Flower girl, May apples, trout lilies, cone flower, bachelor buttons, and finally, love.
Yes.
How do you decide which words to capitalize?
Well, I suppose there is no absolute rule, except that these were all important. They were seasons, the memories of faculty. I have another poem in the book that talks about the mental faculties and during the same period, because Lincoln was reading about that, and the names of the plants, which a lot of people still, it's not stylistically correct, but still capitalize, daisies, dahlias, whatever.
Now, you also capitalize the first letter of each line of your poems throughout this book. That adds a consistency of style throughout. That can be seen as unusual these days. Why did you do that?
Yeah, because a lot of the poems are in free verse, because I suppose it's something I did even before I wrote this book. And there are a lot of poets that do choose to do it that way. I mean, traditionally, poetry, it's perhaps one of the few traditional things that survived, maintained the first letter in capitals. And, of course, with someone like E.E. Cummings, there were no capitals except for, stylistic reasons or for graphic effect. But that is true. All of them, all the lines begin with a cap.
We may have time for one more.
Okay, and I think I'd like to do a poem at the very end of the book, which is called Alternate Ending, and deals, I won't, I guess I can have time to read the whole of the introduction there. Funeral services for President Lincoln were held in the White House on April 19, 1865, and the presidential funeral train left the city of Washington on April 21st, making its first stop in Baltimore. Now, the train stopped all over the place.
And I do need to interrupt you. Sure. We do have a phone caller, and I do want to get to this on line number one. Yes, you're on the Keeping the Faith. Go ahead.
Yes, I find what you're discussing very fascinating, and I'm particularly interested in Lincoln's faith problem. It seems to me from what I've read that the ministers he counseled with about Christian beliefs were consistently conservative and placed a great interest on correct doctrine. And New Salem in Springfield and in Washington, D.C., he seemed to fall into conversations with these people who defined the Christian faith in terms of what you believe. Actually, in the Gospels, it seems to me the real issue is following of Jesus, be loving and serving and being a good neighbor and so forth, is the mark of being there, not having certain beliefs. Is this an impression that is founded in your experience in the study of Lincoln?
Thank you for the call.
Am I on now?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'd say that in terms of living a Christian life, I think Lincoln certainly did. I mean, he was a very moral man in almost every aspect, very ethical. You know, Honest Abe was a well-earned nickname in his case. And you're, of course, raising the whole question of the difference between faith and good works, you know, and is it what you believe or what you do? In terms of what he did, Lincoln could certainly be considered a Christian, and particularly with his sympathy for the underdog and his belief that everyone should be helped. And I think he had a very strong, you know, I guess, sociological morality. He really believed in helping everyone. That came through at various times during the Civil War, particularly. And during, as I said, during the last years of the war, he really did believe in God's providence.
Let's hear the poem, alternate ending, with maybe a one-sentence introduction.
Well, this is Lincoln speaking from the tomb.
Yes.
In Oak Ridge Cemetery in Springfield. No, it wasn't supposed to end this way. Mourners lining the railroad tracks, miles of black crepe and patriotic bunting. I was supposed to become the regent of Reconstruction or a continental tourist so I could practice my German on sight. Even a pilgrim in Jerusalem. Of course, all the while I'd write my memoirs, making obscene profits as a corporation lawyer. Yet here I am, the sentinel of Oak Ridge, watching the comings and goings, savoring the passage of time, which is like snow, redesigning the contours of the land, a soft tattoo like prairie showers on cedar shakes in that other world I once so happily inhabited.
The poem Alternate Ending by Dan Gullery, from his collection, The Lincoln Poems, the last poem in the book, hearing the voice of the imagined Lincoln coming from the grave in Springfield. Mm-hmm. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. I've enjoyed very much speaking with Professor Gullery today about his most recent book, The Lincoln Poems. He has another book coming out next year, also from Mayhaven Publishing, People and Places in the Land of Lincoln. But what we've been hearing today are some of the introductions to the poems and the poems themselves from the Lincoln poems. A nice hand drawing, line drawing of Lincoln on the cover of this book. You can find it in your local bookstores, or you may order it online from mayhavenpublishing.com. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, we'll be talking with Amy Kandrak from Indianapolis, Indiana, about her project called What Friends Do, that help people in times of illness or crisis know how to respond to family and friends. And on December 20, we'll be talking about Bethlehem today. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
I was going to say
you've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, this is Julie Pride, administrator of the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. Our community has experienced one wave of the H1N1 pandemic. During this time, thousands were sick and several required hospitalization. The H1N1 pandemic is not over. We can expect at least two more waves of illness. we have an opportunity to make sure that we have community immunity by the time the next wave comes through. Everyone who can take the H1N1 shot or missed should do so. It is especially important for persons with an underlying health condition and children and young adults to be vaccinated. Children 9 years of age and under will require two doses at least 28 days apart. Visit willconnect.org/health and click on the Illinois map to find a health department near you or call my office for help at 217-352-7961.
Remember Kyoto? Now it's Copenhagen. The UN's current climate treaty, the Kyoto Protocol, was never ratified by the US, and now we're in the hot seat. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk with Gaia theorist James Lovelock and Whole Earth Catalog founder Stuart Brand. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening at 7.
This is WILL AM 580.